and welcome to this week's Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham, and we are hurtling through space and time with the brilliant assistance of OldFootballShirts.com. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome a man who is an Albion hero. He was born in Seaford and he went on to play 386 games for the Albion in a career that spanned 14 years and has been immortalised in Attila the Stockbroker's landmark poem, Goldstone Ghost. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Brian Powley. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, it's great stuff. Good to see you. I don't know, was Attila right? Was Brian Powley brave and squat? Of all things,
are you actually familiar with the poem? Firstly, actually,
no, I'm not. Actually,
okay, Goldstone Ghost was written. I know that probably most of it. It was written for the last day of the Goldstone, and it was the poet's kind of personal odyssey from his first game in 1966 through to the last game in 97, and it goes, you know, in chronological order about how, you know, the great the world was, because it goes to. Villa in the big crunch game, a 30,000 crowd, bald lockhead school, but we still won the day. Brian Powley, brave and squat, TMs and scarf on wrist, okay. Now, one, Andy Lockhead didn't score for Villa that day. Bruce Rioch did. But he referred to you as brave and squat. So if this is how the fans felt about you, how do you feel about being now referred to, you know, 40 years after this, being brave and squat?
Well, I don't know about brave. I think I was probably stupid, but squat. Yeah, I was. My playing height was 5'9", so that was quite short.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning here then, because we're talking before the show, and you've never left Seaford. You were born there, and you went on to manage them after you were retired, and you played for them as well, didn't you, at some point?
Very early days. Yeah. I actually played for Seaford, yeah.
But you're also known to be a star gymnast in your youth.
What?
I think that's a bit over-exaggerated. I did gymnastics, but there was far better people at gymnastics than I was.
Right, okay. So, I mean, bearing in mind that we know that star gymnasts are, well, I suppose sort of the girls are kind of, you know, about 4'3" and weigh about, you know, 6 pounds or something, whatever it is, and the lads are kind of strapping. So what was your discipline? What did you throw? Did you throw yourself around? Did you twirl yourself around?
No, I just did the general antics of what they do in gymnastics with the support of the games master. But no, I think it's totally over-exaggerated that I was anything like a star gymnast, I can tell you.
But I mean, but doing that would have helped you with things like agility for being a goalkeeper.
Yeah, I think so. But I wouldn't get confused between the two. I think it's all about anticipation and reaction.
Right.
Even, to be honest with you.
I've
just got it in mind in that case, because, you know, just thinking of the pommel horse. Not the pommel horse. Yeah, the pommel horse. And or either used for gymnastics or escaping from German POW camps.
But you were born in post-war Britain, so born in 1944.
Post-war, mate. I think it was still going on at
still
the time.
Still going on, yeah.
Still going on.
Grew up in post-war.
Yes. Your basic history, mate, needs a bit... buffing up.
So what was it like growing up in Sussex back then?
Well, growing up in Seaford, because Seaford, I love Seaford to death. It's a beautiful place. It's got everything there. It's got the Crookmere Valley. It's got the Seaford Head Golf Course. It's got the Blashington Golf Course. It's got the sea. It's got Friston Forest. To me, it's a wonderful place to live. And I was very, very fortunate that I managed to get into professional football with Brighton and play my whole career in one club and living in the town I loved with my fairly large post-war family.
I was about to say, so in those days, I mean, was Seaford like, was the rest of the world in black and white, which is how we see it now?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Really, yeah.
No colour?
Yeah, no. I you know, it's a place that I'm quite well-travelled around the world, and I've travelled, obviously, the length and breadth of the UK playing football and everything. I've always been pleased to get back to Seaford.
Yeah.
Okay. So you, how did it come about you going to the Albion?
I was in my early days. I was playing a lot of football and rugby. Then with the school, we were playing in a seven-a-side competition at Howsham. The goalkeeper was having a bit of a bad time, so the school teacher changed me for him. I went in goal, had a reasonable time, and then I got selected for the school team. Seaford Boys Club asked me to play for them occasionally, only occasionally, because I was only 13 at the time. Then one day, a knock on the door, Brian, we need you to play in goal this afternoon. Can you be down the Sorks Recreation Ground? Boom. Gets down the Sorks Recreation Ground. We're playing Eastbourne United Youth, who had won everything in Sussex for donkey's years.
Right.
And we got beat 18-0. But yes. I had the game of my life because they never were out of our penalty area. The following Tuesday, I was invited by Jack Mansell. Obviously, he got to hear through the Eastbourne United coach.
Yeah.
To go over and train with them, which I did. I played for Eastbourne United youth team, third team, second team. I was never good enough to get in the first team at that time because they had a good goalkeeper called Reggie Pope, who was actually shorter than me, believe it or not, but he was a cracking goalkeeper. And Jack Mansell then pushed me on. I had trials with Arsenal, Southampton, and I could have gone to both of those clubs, but in those days, you know, they were offering something like £5 a week and live in a hostel.
Mm.
And I didn't fancy that. Because I thought these were bigger clubs than Brighton. A lesser club, I'd have more chance to be noticed. So then Jack Mansell pushed me into Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
And then I played for their youth team in the Metropolitan League, which was a brilliant league in those days. Had all the London A-sides playing in that league.
When you say A-sides, we're basically talking about the reserve sides here, aren't we?
Well, no, third team, actually. A-side, it was the ABC side. You know, the A-teams were the third team in the setup.
Okay.
Before the youth team.
Okay.
So, and we were playing West Ham, Arsenal, Tottenham, all their youth teams. And because we were struggling a bit, I was performing very well behind probably a poor defence, which got me noticed.
So how old were you at the time?
16.
So this is, you'd have been playing, and if we're talking the late 50s here into the very early 60s, you know, when you're saying you're playing against, you know, West Ham and Tottenham and Arsenal, I mean, there's probably some great stars of the future that you might well have been playing against.
Well, one thing, John O'Rourke was a great player. He played for Arsenal. He went up to Middlesbrough and played against him. Johnny Sissons at West Ham.
Martin Peters
at West Ham. God knows, it's a long time ago now, but
sure.
they had a lot of youth internationals playing for. And, of course, it brought out the best in me because, you know, Brighton weren't, you know, the best side in the world.
Mm.
And we were under a lot of pressure, and it got me noticed. And at the end of the, I think it was the 60-61 season, Brighton actually got relegated from the second division.
Mm. It's actually the following year, but yeah.
Was it? Okay,
yeah,
Yeah. And... George Curtis played three kids in the side at Derby.
Yes.
And I was only 16 at the time, and I actually played my very first league game at Derby.
Grief. I was just going to say, because there's, you know, we do actually do a small smidgen, well, AD does a lot of research, I do a little bit of research, and we're back to Tim Carter's book. And there is actually a bit in there where there was an under-21 England game at the Goldstone in about 1961, I think it said, or 60-61. And it's interesting seeing who was playing for England. They were playing against the Netherlands, who were not a footballing country at the time.
Mm.
They won 4-3, but it's interesting to see who was playing. And we mentioned Martin Peters there. Ron Harris probably would have been, Neil Young played in that day. This game was at the Goldstone, by the way, that's why I'm mentioning it.
Yeah.
Goalkeeper was Jim Montgomery, who went on to make famous saves for Sunderland in the cup final sort of a few years later. So you're mentioning your... So when you say you were at the Albion for XYZ years, why was it you felt that there was three sort of, as you put it, kids that started this particular game? Why was that?
Well, because George Curtis, who was manager at the Albion at the time, and Brighton were relegated. He thought,
already relegated.
Yeah, they're already relegated, so he... He played on. He played three kids to give them first team experience,
mm-hmm.
And we went up to Derby,
yes.
And we got beat 2-1. I had a very, very good game, but actually incurred a very serious knee injury, actually, which actually dogged my whole career.
Oh, right.
Yeah, right through.
Wow. Well, I've got to actually this. So we've got 18th of May 1962.
Correct.
I've got the 11 here.
Mm-hmm.
Of which only one, there's one player who is his only appearance, and I can't actually find what his Christian name is. So, test for you then, Brian. Mm. Who was the 11 that you were?
Oh, God.
Right, well, number one's fairly easy.
Yeah.
Who would have been at number two? And I think that this was another debutante.
I can't remember.
Okay, seriously. Shall I go through the team then for you? Let's see how many. Okay, number two was John Standing.
Yeah, he was a debutant, John. Yeah.
Okay, Bobby Baxter.
Yep.
I think it's Dave Smith.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. He went on to manage Burnley, I think, Dave Smith.
Got ya. Mm-hmm. Number five, the skipper, that was
Roy Jennings.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Number six, I think one of the few was one of two ever presents that season.
Jack Bertolini.
He was number eight. He was mm-hmm. one ever present. The other one, I think we mentioned him in a conversation we had a couple of days ago. Did well at Arsenal.
Go on.
Steve Burtonshaw.
Oh, Steve! Yeah,
yes. mm-hmm. yeah.
Of course, he went to Arsenal after his career,
yeah,
didn't he?
As a coach. I think he was mm-hmm. He was a caretaker manager for a short time. Number seven was Tony Nicholas.
Yeah.
Nine. We had eight was Jack Bertolini. Nine was Johnny Cavan.
Cavan, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And 10, Phil Gilbert.
Yeah, he was a debutant. Yeah. Phil, yeah.
And then 11, I've got, and I can't find, I've gone through Tim Carter's book. It just says A. Miller. Yeah, and Brian's shaking his head there, which we can all see on radio, which on Super Reverb Vision, which we don't actually have anymore. Yeah, Brian's shaking his head, and I think we are a little bit... W. Miller, fine, but he ended up going to play for Trumpton, but...
one thing that I've always liked to do, every time we have a player in here, I always used to go... I like to go through the old programmes and find out who was playing at the Brighton Centre when you made your debut. Now, unfortunately, the Brighton Centre wasn't actually around when you made your debut, but I have got from Ian Hines' magnificent website,
Seagulls
programs, and he's got pretty much every program going from
the
40s
forwards.
So what
was happening in May 1962 then?
Well, there's an advert for a place called Bodega in Ship Street.
Bodega, Bodega?
Yeah.
Well, that's Spanish, kind of a Spanish thing.
Yep, but at the Savoy Cinema there was Carry On Cruising.
And, Savoy Cinema, was that the one? Hang on, is that the one that was? It's just down from the Gloucester. I think
that sounds very appropriate for Brighton. That title,
doesn't it? Yeah. At the Astoria was El Cid.
Sorry, that was the one that's down mm-hmm. from the Gloucester.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah.
Where was the Esoldo Cinema? I've got no idea.
That's on tiny little thing on Western Road, right on the border of Brighton and Hove. On Western Road. I think it's a pizza shop nowadays.
And the Hippodrome.
I could be wrong, by the way, about that one. It's just there was a lot of cinemas floating around town.
The Hippodrome was a variety theatre.
Yeah, and South Pacific was on.
I actually saw the Beatles live there.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know that they played there, but...
Mm. And something that would have really pleased my dad, at the Sports Stadia, or the SS Brighton, as it was known, the Brighton Tigers were playing, and... I can't read what it says in this light, but they were playing Streatham.
Streatham, yes, uh-huh. They always seem to play Streatham. Yes, I mean, Brighton Tigers used to win kind of everything. I think, you know, with all due respect to the chap on my right here, it was kind of the ice hockey team was the one that won lots and lots of things.
The Brighton Tigers, they were a massive, massive team back then, weren't they?
I got to know Roy Shepherd very well, who was one time captain of Brighton Tigers.
Yeah.
Lovely man, and he had a lovely wife.
Right.
I mean that as a very nice person.
So what he means, yes, very nice family. AD, behave yourself.
She was gorgeous.
Well, yeah, all right, okay, fine.
Okay, so you got your chance in that one game at the end of that season, but it took a while for you to really establish yourself in the Brighton first team. So I mean, mm-hmm. the season after that. I mean, how many games did you play that season?
Probably about half a dozen, I think. That was in the third division.
Mm.
I only came in really when other goalkeepers were injured.
So it was the first choice that you were kind of looking out, that you were deputising for?
I think Bert McGonagall was the first choice in those days. I think I only played about six games that. Because we went straight down. Didn't
I was about to say,
so
it's not
division.
The most auspicious starts to your career, is it? I mean,
well,
your first two seasons you play.
I was only 17, remember?
Oh, not I'm blaming you, but.
That's very nice of you. Thanks.
But first two seasons as a pro, and we go down both times.
Yeah, well, exactly. But,
I mean, obviously, being a footballer, I mean, you weren't really established in the team, and it was obviously still your dream to be the Brighton and Hove Albion number one. But did you have a trade to fall back on if it did all go horribly wrong?
Not really. No. When I left school, for the first sort of 8 to 10 months before I actually got fixed up with the football club, I was doing this in apostrophes apprentice plumber. But I never signed any forms because I knew what I wanted to do and I knew I wasn't going to stay with it. So as soon as the opportunity came on, you know, I signed apprentice professional forms for Brighton, which means I could get paid for it.
Mm.
And so, quite funny is my dad, who used to work a 48-hour week, was earning £14 a week. And my first professional contract as an apprentice professional with Brighton was £16 a week.
Yeah, but your dad loved you.
Well, you know.
Right, as soon as you're the breadwinner now, son.
He was pleased for me. You know?
Absolutely.
Mm. So, I mean, what does that equate to in today's money?
Oh, God knows.
God knows. I'm not a financial expert, and I'm not about to try and make some, you know, ludicrous guess.
But having
guess.
Said that, the maximum wage was still in effect then.
£20.
£24
was
£24 a week.
Right. Mm.
So you're making your way. You were playing for Brighton. What sort of crowds was the average? Would you say?
Well,
about
don't
that?
Forget at that time the first team were going through a poor time,
mm.
And I think they were probably getting around about 10, 11, 12,000, which, you know, having a bad time in those divisions wasn't bad.
Mm.
But
I mean, who were the characters in those teams back then for you? Who really?
Who were the ones that put your arm around you and said, "Right, Brian, you know, we're going to make it." Who was your kind of Svengali? You must have had one.
Well, I don't know really because I was so far removed from the first team because I was a kid. Mm. You know, my first 6 months was on the ground staff. You know, sweeping terraces, cleaning toilets, you know, washing.
Whose boots did you have to clean?
Most of the first teams.
Oh right.
Yeah, yeah, and most of the type so and so's didn't drop me a you know a
not shilling
bob you know, mm. But no, you know, that was you're so far removed from the first mm. team, and then suddenly you're in the first team, and you're looking at these players like gods to think, you know, I'm actually playing in the first. And I can remember playing like my first game at Derby with Tony Nicholas, as you say, Jack Bertolini. Jack Bertolini was one of the players I really admired because right. he was the hardest tackler I've ever seen, but he wasn't dirty. He was so hard, so fair, and such an honest professional. And I thought he was one of the best players I've ever seen at Brighton,
mm.
even so, to the modern day.
I mean, you're saying that, you know, you felt like you were a youngster, you were kind of a bit removed from the first team. So when you got to the first team and you're playing with your heroes, did you feel that you were welcomed into it, or do you feel that you had to kind of prove yourself to them as well?
Well, I think you're right by saying that because the teams were going through bad times at the time. Every, you know, all the lads were lacking in confidence. They tend to be attacking their teammates, and you know, unfairly, I think, you know, and it wasn't a great atmosphere. But having said that, when you're trying to get, you know, into the inner circle of the first team or whatever it is, you've got to shut all that out and just play for yourself, yeah. which I did, and reasonably successfully in those days.
I mean, because one would imagine that, you know, it certainly has to be the case now, but one imagines that certainly as a goalkeeper, you've got to have an excellent communication relationship, certainly with the two centre-backs that you've got mm. there. And when you've got, yeah. you know, a huge fella like, you know, Roy Jennings, who's, you know, yeah. like you say, deputy god yeah. at the club. I mean, you know, was there ever a time where you got to ball at him?
Roy, no, not really. Roy was quite frightening to me because Roy was very much the old-fashioned centre-half.
Yeah.
Big stopper, tough as nails, honest. But he didn't suffer idiots, and you know, if you made a mistake, he would let you know. And I felt as a young kid, 16, 17, mm. you know, I thought Roy was quite harsh. I mean, he would come down on you like a ton of bricks if you made a mistake. And I remember playing with a guy called Bob McNichol,
mm-hmm.
who came from Burnley to Brighton before my time. But I got to play with him, and this guy installed confidence in me as a goalkeeper. If I made a mistake, no, my son, next time, you'd do it fine. You know, Roy would bawl you out for 20 minutes and you'd end up almost in tears.
Mm.
But Bob McNichol, on the other hand, was a guy that sort of, you know, he was the, you know, the gentle touch. He would come mm. in and give you confidence to
so did,
play
did
well.
Did Roy ever get to praise then? I mean, was he just sort of slow to praise, quick to criticise? I mean, did he
yeah,
ever...
I thought Roy was slow to praise, quick to criticise, yeah.
Right.
But, I mean, initially you were, you mentioned earlier, you were pretty much third choice initially, and you were behind Charlie Baker and Bert McGonagall, as you,
yeah,
as you
that
mentioned.
Was in very early
I mean,
days,
did,
yeah.
I mean, did they pass on any inspiration? I mean, these days you see all the goalkeepers training together and they're all thick as thieves and
yeah.
all hang out together. Was it the same back then?
Yeah, I think, you know, we trained. In those days, Charlie Baker was first team goalkeeper, but he was part time. So he never trained with us. Yeah, he was a part time goalkeeper.
Right.
And I think when George Curtis took over, because George Curtis actually signed me, when he took over, he didn't want Charlie as a part-time professional. I think he wanted Charlie to become a full-time professional, and I don't think Charlie wanted it. Charlie Baker was a very good goalkeeper.
Mm.
Bert McGonagall came over from Ireland, and to me, he wasn't the greatest goalkeeper I've ever seen. So I was getting a bit anxious when, you know, he was getting picked in front of me, because I thought I was every bit as good, if not better.
Even at 17?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, so what was Charlie Baker's sort of other half job then?
Do you know, I don't know. I think he was a plumber, but I'm not sure.
Right. Baker the plumber.
Mm.
So which manager was it that really took you under his wing? Because, I mean, when you first signed, it was George Curtis in charge.
Yeah.
He left in 63 and Archie McCauley took over.
Yeah.
I mean, what was your relationship like with those two managers?
George Curtis was a very, very good coach, and he really believed in young players. But you see, when a side is struggling, you haven't got time to develop young players, and I think that was his big mistake. You know, he's bringing people like me on and a few others. But ultimately, his focus should have been on the players he got or bringing in more senior professionals. That was the problem. He got elbowed out, and then Archie McCauley took over, who I never liked. Archie.
Go on.
I never liked him at all because we hardly ever saw him in training. He wasn't a man you could really trust. You couldn't trust his word. And he'd be playing you in the first team, and then suddenly he would pull you out and give you all this rubbish reasons why he's going to try something else. And not only with me, but with a few other players as well. And I didn't trust him, and quite frankly, I didn't like him.
You find that a little bit dishonest, do you? I mean,
yeah,
if you're not being given a genuine reason for...
That's right.
I mean, you'll take criticism if you know you've done wrong. You don't need the criticism sometimes, but...
No.
Or if you don't necessarily realise you've done something wrong, someone tells you, think, actually, yeah, I did do wrong there, but you felt that he wasn't even sort of doing that.
No. I mean, I actually played under him in the fourth division when we won the fourth division. I played, I think.
Winning the fourth division in 1964.
And okay. I think I played something like 44 games in that season. I can't remember. 42, 44 games.
Yeah.
I know I played most of the season.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that I was every week having to virtually battle for my position.
Know? So. But the thing is that not sort of a healthy thing to feel that you're actually, you know, it keeps you on your toes that you've got some competition that's there to sort of like nip in there if you do make a slip?
Yeah, it was. But I can remember when we drew Chelsea at home in the Cup. Tony Burns had come in from Arsenal, and Tony and I were great mates. When we played Chelsea at home, I'd been in the first team for some time. The previous week we played at Peterborough away, and I had a very good game. I think we got beat 2-1, but I had a very good game, and I thought, right, I'm in the team next week. Right up to the Friday, when we had a team meeting in the director's box, whatever you call it. It was a shed under the West Stand at the time.
Yeah.
Archie came in about after 2 hours of keeping us waiting, which he always did.
A bit rude.
And because Archie liked his tipple. And he liked his glass of whiskey, and he came in, and he named the team from right back to outside left,
and but not the goalkeeper.
No, and we all looking at each other, and Burnsy and I looked at each other, and I sort of, you know,
shrugged shoulders. Sorry, Super Reverb Vision wouldn't allow the fact that Brian's just shrugged his shoulders there.
So, so one of the lads, I think it was Bobby Baxter, spoke up and said, "Archie, who's in goal?" And he said, if Tony Haight is playing, Tony, you're in goal. But if he's not playing, Brian, you're in goal.
So what was the difference then with this particular player?
Well, Tony Haight was a big guy. Tony Burns was a tall guy, but wasn't particularly great in the air. So within like 3 minutes of Archie saying that, there was a knock on the door. In came the secretary to say, we've just heard that Tony Haight is playing tomorrow. It was such a setup. That was the man. He didn't have the bottle to turn to me and say, I'm leaving you out. Because of this. And if he'd said that, that was fair enough. If he'd have said he's leaving me out because he thinks Tony Burns might be able to handle Tony Haightley better than me, I could have swallowed that.
Yeah.
But he didn't. It was a load of nonsense.
It's just,
you know,
sort of a backhanded way of doing things. Yeah. But the thing is, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I suppose it's the same with any sort of person. I mean, you can't have necessarily, you know, of a squad of 20, let's say, that, you know, you've made it clear you're not a big fan of Archie McCauley, but, you know, the next person might be. And yet somehow, somewhere down the line, he managed to get the team promoted.
Yeah, he did. And
let's champions.
Yes, yeah. And I think a lot to do with that is he signed Bobby Smith.
Mm.
And I think Bobby Smith, because first of all, he got the crowds in. I can remember the opening day of the season, we played Barrow at home in front of 22,000 people in the fourth division. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
Do you remember, do you remember what you were thinking the day that you heard that Bobby Smith was coming to the club?
Yeah, I thought, great. I thought, it's just what we need.
Do you think it was like the 1st of April or something? It was a bit of a wind-up?
Not really.
Did you know he was kind of on? He was, because what I mean is his fall was pretty spectacular. He was at Spurs, all right. He wasn't necessarily sort of, you know, doing the business too much, but to go from there all the way down to the fourth division and a not particularly coherent, as you say, sort of, you know, not particularly sort of well collective fourth division side is you know. All right, those who are there can obviously remember it and thinking, great, but it doesn't ever sound like a move that makes sense, does it?
Well, I don't know, really. I think it does in the sense that he was a crowd puller.
Yes.
And let's face it, if you get a good crowd behind you, it's your 12th player, whatever you want to call him.
Mm.
But we also had people like Jack Smith in the side and Jimmy Collins in the side. Jimmy Collins was a very, very good... He came from Tottenham as well. I think he preempted Bobby Smith. Jimmy Collins, I think, was an underrated player because he was very, very skillful on his touch and he could hit a 50-yard ball out of sight. But he was another guy that could destroy you with a comment.
Oh, right.
Jimmy, he wasn't the greatest of motivators, but he was a very good player and that's what you needed.
Mm.
We had some good players in that side, which, you know, got us promotion, and I never thought really it was down to Archie in a lot of ways. I think it was down to the players.
Mm. And who really stood out in that team for you, though, as a player, as the man, the leader, the one that did actually get there if it wasn't the manager?
I thought obviously Bobby Smith, and I thought Jimmy Collins.
Mm.
I think those were the two that sort of really.
Were they kind of more inspiring to the others? I mean, were they leaders as such, or were they kind of just...
Yeah, they were leaders. They were. I think as a young player, I was very wary of Jimmy. Bobby Smith was one of these players that went out and played his game and was very, very successful with Brighton. And I love Bobby Smith to death. I really did. Jimmy, I was always a bit wary of.
Right.
Okay. Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As usual, we are sponsored by oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us a shirt of the week. And
is he giving us a stinker?
We've had a lot of bad shirts on this show.
Oh no,
we've had a lot of
bad. And you're going to ask Brian to describe it?
Phil, what's wrong with you, mate?
I mean, this is just spiteful.
This is properly
okay,
mingled. This will come
it.
Up on our Facebook page at some point. But here, I'm just going to pass this one over to. Can you just try your very best to describe what you're seeing
without swearing?
This is a green and black goalkeeper sweater by the look of it.
Yes, it is.
With a big pair of gloves. Am I allowed to mention that name?
Yes, you can.
Under the awards logo.
It's kind of the gloves are actually sewn into the kind of the,
it looks like
the fabric
it, yeah.
of the
Yeah,
of
and
the
it,
shirt
it looks a bit
itself.
Of like a chessboard.
Yeah.
And on the top, I think it's got AVEC, is it? Or AMEX? That's AVEC, isn't
AVEC.
It?
AVEC. That's the manufacturer.
But having said that, looking at some of the goalkeepers... outfits these, you know, it goes with the fashion, I think, to be honest with you.
It's
a bit leery, put it that way. Yeah.
Would you have worn that?
No, I don't think so. I'd have been a bit... I was always a bit embarrassed. I was a bit quiet and shy when I played.
Can we put a year on this one?
I'm going to... Well, the thing is, this is at the time when goalkeeper shirts were truly revolting, so I have to say 94.
Close. Okay. This is from 96, 97.
Okay.
And he goes, here, and this is what Phil says. Here's your shirt of the week. This is a 1996, 97 Sheffield United goalie shirt worn by the likes of Alan Kelly and Simon Tracy. It's a classic mid-90s madness design, and he was rather taken by the pattern of the goalie's gloves on the front. Simon Tracy made over 340 appearances in his career, and the first ever game was for Wimbledon in the 1988 Charity Shield. Dave Bessett had been sold after the FA Cup final, and he played just one league game for the Dons before he moved to the Blades, where he played for the next 15 years. Alan Kelly Jr. had an equally illustrious career in Sheffield, turning out over 200 times between 92 and 99, and made 34 appearances for the Republic of Ireland. Phil's given us a couple of goalkeeper shirt story because he likes to do that sort of thing.
Go on, man.
I'm going to start with my favourite one here because it's brilliant, actually. In fact, I'm going to ask a question. Do you know what John Burridge wore underneath his goalkeeper shirt?
No, I don't.
Kevlar.
He wore a Superman outfit.
Same thing.
And St Etienne goalkeeper Jérémy Jeannot was known throughout France for his hatred of Olympique Lyonnais, the traditional rivals of St Etienne. In 2004, after Lyon had been knocked out of Europe by AC Milan, he wore an AC Milan shirt for their game against them the following week.
And that's a goalkeeper.
That was a goalkeeper.
That's a bit obsessive, that is.
There we go.
Okay.
But
thanks, yeah. Phil. It's revolting.
There we go. Well, moving on. Okay, so, Brian, you made 386 appearances for us, and which was a record for a Sussex-born and bred player. Going back in those days, these days we have lots of multinational squads and everything, and it's very rare that we actually get a local player coming through. We've got Lewis Dunk, he's currently on 196 appearances, sorry, 194 appearances,
right,
for the club,
okay.
So he's coming up to 200. But I've got the list of Sussex-born player appearances here, which, you used to top the post-war list, but how did you feel when Kerry Mayo got your record?
I didn't realise he had.
There you go.
Kerry Mayo's got your record.
Has he?
Yeah. But so,
no, I think the point is that, you know...
For what? Sorry?
Number of appearances for the Albion. A Sussex-born player that's number of appearances for the Albion. So,
really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so number one was...
I love your stats, don't you?
Number one was pre-war, which was Bert Longstaff. He played 443 times.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and then this.
What position did Kerry play? I can't remember.
He was a left back.
Yeah. I think I made, and forgive me if I'm wrong, I think I made the most appearances as a goalkeeper.
I think you are the most prolific goalkeeper.
And
for
I think I was the longest serving goalkeeper.
You yes. have.
Yeah. That's where I think
those are the records that are important, AD. Yeah. Never mind knocking him onto numbers 2, 3, and 4. But let's talk about Brian Pownie, number one.
Yeah. But just to give the rest of those, Kerry Mayo made as 413, then Brian 386, Adam Elab 342, and Ian Chapman 331 is the list. But hopefully, touchwood, Lewis Dunk will get onto that list.
Yeah, whatever.
I knew Lewis Dunk's old man very well. He's dead.
All right.
Good player. He was a big centre half. Used to play for Whitehawk, and he was a very good player.
Yeah.
I wonder why they'll chip off the old block.
Yeah.
The amount of people I know who seem to know Lewis's dad, it's amazing.
Well, he was very well known in the county league in those days because Whitehawk was a very good side.
Yeah.
And he was a very good player with them.
So we're talking about the 1964-65 season. We won the fourth division, possibly despite Archie McCauley, who knows. But as the 60s wore on, one, we lost the Stripes. I'd love to know the reason behind that. Maybe you know.
No, I don't know why.
Fine. But we're also talking about sort of, you know, other players that were brought through. I mean, as another chap that we've got to talk about, as a good teammate of yours and played with you, played alongside you for, you know, a good sort of 8-9 years, is our good friend Norman Gall. I mean, you know, tell us about Sir Norman.
Well, Norman, to me, we started our careers together and we finished it together. We started at the same time and we finished at the same time.
Yeah, you actually had a joint testimonial, didn't you?
We did indeed. Two testimonial matches, actually. And also his firstborn was born on the same day as my firstborn.
Wow.
So that's
same hospital?
No, I don't think so.
Right.
Because Norman was over in Shoreham Way, I think, at the time. I was over at Seaford Eastbourne Way. But no... sorry, you were going to say something there?
No, I was going to say, tell us about your time of playing alongside Norman.
Norman was one of these players. He was so consistent. And we talk about today. We've got Dumphy and...
Duffy and Dunk.
Yeah. Who a lot of people, the ex-Liverpool player the other day was harmonious about their ability, and I totally agree with them. I think he said something like, "If Jamie Carragher."
Yeah.
Jamie Carragher. He said, "If anything happens to those two, Brighton will go down." I admit that he's right in saying that they are very, 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 very strong players.
So we've got Conor Goldson and Uwe Hoenemaier, who are equally as inept if anything did happen to them. But yeah, go on.
Yeah. I look at Norman Gore and John Napier as when I played behind them, they were great to play behind, as I'm sure the current keeper
must think
now about the two centre-halves he's got. But Norman, to me, was A, an absolute gentleman. B, he was very, very consistent player. And I've been asked this many times before, who, over my career, was the most outstanding player at Brighton, and I've always said it was Norman Gore.
Really?
Yeah.
What made him outstanding? Give us his qualities on the pitch. I mean, you said, you know, he's a gentleman off the pitch.
But... Yeah. Well, he was a gentleman on the pitch. I mean, his ability, he wasn't a very big man, Norman. He could get up and hang and win balls in the air. He would get up in the other penalty area and score. He could read a game well. I think we had an understanding, to be honest with you, and the understanding led to Norman and John together. I think when we won the third division, we were runners up in the third division.
Yeah.
But you know, I look at the two current centre halves at Brighton. In fact, I look at the back four, and I think they are brilliant. The back four at Brighton at the moment.
Sure.
I think the captain is
getting on a bit.
But for his age, he is such a consistent and steady player and so skillful. I think he's absolutely brilliant. But Norman. To me, if there's any honours going at the club, I would give them to Norman.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you did have, like we mentioned earlier, you did actually have your testimonial together. It was a game against Chelsea. It's on the 5th of May, 1972. The programme cost 3p. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. we had actually another game before that. We played Wolves at home in a testimonial. We had a joint testimonial. We played Wolves first, and then a later one we played Chelsea.
Uh-huh.
We also went around the local pubs playing darts against pub sides to raise, you know, money.
Who was the better dart player, you or Norman?
Do you know, I can't remember.
Probably we could always stage a rematch.
Probably me, I think. Yeah. But, we also went around playing snooker against certain... I can remember playing snooker at the Brighton post office one night.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the players that was playing against me was an old friend from Seaford, who had actually moved to Brighton, and he was their best player. Well, by the time I was playing him last, and by the time I got on, I was three sheets to the wind, and I wasn't really a good snooker player, but I beat him. I don't think he ever forgave me for that.
That double vision
does
help
sometimes.
His name
was Ted Streeter, believe it or not.
Hang on. That the same bloke. Hang on, Ted Streeter. Where do we down at the name Ted Streeter from? He's some sort of physio. Remind me. Come on. I'm slacking here.
You are slacking. I've got absolutely no
Ted
idea.
Street, I know the name. I'm trying to think here, but anyway.
But you mentioned there that that 1971-72 season where you finished as runners-up to...
We finished as runners-up. Just because we weren't there, we finished as runners-up.
I wasn't even born.
No, I was.
But it was...
So just be rude to our guests, don't you?
But, you finished runners-up that year to Aston Villa. It was quite an eventful season. Was that the season that Willie Irvine scored that goal?
Yeah.
I'm led to believe there was a fun-packed game at Carlisle away.
Oh, God. Yeah. I'm not good at remembering games.
Well, shall I tell you what I've got written here?
Yeah. Go on.
Yeah. Because I've been having a natter with our friend John Templeman this week.
Mm-hmm. So he's
did you get did you get a word in?
You haven't met AD, have you?
But this is what he had to say, and this is what he says about
Templeman
you.
Verbatim, is it?
Yeah.
Go on then.
He says, "I must say, Brian was and still is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. He was a fantastic goalkeeper. It may be a painful memory for him." He says, "We were playing Carlisle away in 1972-73, and Bobby Owen, the ex-Man City striker, was put through with only Brian to beat. It was a 50-50 on who was going to get to the ball first. Brian and Owen collided at the edge of the area. Bobby Owen got a toe to the ball, and it went past Brian into the empty goal. Brian was left on the ground with a nasty facial injury and had to be stretchered off. As he passed our dugout, I heard him ask if Bobby Owen had scored. Brian had broken his nose, and his first thought is if he had conceded the goal. That was Brian, always thinking of the team first.
I remember getting the broken nose there, yeah. But that broken nose was one of six I had. Seriously. The last broken nose I had, I was playing rugby after I finished football, and it straightened my nose. Because my nose sort of went at right angles.
Your nose is not a boxer's nose, is it?
No. Well, actually, I've had a surgery on my nose this year. I had a cancerous thing removed from it.
Oh, blimey.
So that was a hell of a bloody operation as well.
I can imagine, yes. Yeah, but yeah. I was about to say, that's quite a handsome hoot you got. I mean, like I say, I saw pictures of Roy Jennings. Now, that's a boxer's nose.
Yeah.
That's kind of something straight out of Eagle or Dan, you know, Roy the Rovers, that kind of thing. But, you know, Brian's still quite the handsome chap here, you know.
Well, really?
Yeah. Well, nothing personal, you know. Yeah. But, you know, he's quite a handsome chap. But so. Yeah, so that 71-72 season, I mean, that was. Did you feel, you know, as time was going by, did you, or rather even at the beginning of the season, did you think, because by this time I think it was Pat Sable was the manager, wasn't it?
Pat Sable was my favourite manager.
Favourite manager. And we completely bypassed
Freddie Goodwin.
Well,
I got Freddie Goodwin. I like Freddie Goodwin. But again, he was another manager that I had to keep proving myself to all the time, because one of the strangest things he did when he came back from America, he brought Jeff Sidebottom back with him.
Uh-huh.
Now, Jeff was, you know, a very mature player at that time. He's well into his mid-30s. And he brought Jeff over with him back from America and put him straight in the first team.
Right.
Well, I was there with Tony Burns, and with all due respect, I think we were a good couple of goalkeepers, and I just wondered why we needed a third goalkeeper, right? And Jeff never really wanted to play.
Oh.
Because when he first joined the club, he said to me, he said, Brian, he said, I don't play football at Christmas. So I said to him, I said to him, why is that? Are you religious? He said, no. He said, I just don't want to.
Oh.
And nearly every occasion, well, I think over the 3 years or so he was here, he never played at Christmas. He always either got an injury or I was in the
diplomatic
side
injury.
Because
anyway.
Christmas, you would have been playing Christmas Day and Boxing Day then, wouldn't you?
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Not Christmas Day, no. We'd play, depending what day Boxing Day fell on. Yeah, we'd play on the Saturday, and then Boxing Day, if it fell on the Monday, we'd play on the, you know.
Yeah. Christmas Day games finished in the 50s, mate.
No, we never played on Christmas Day, no.
No. So
I remember travelling on Christmas Day once. We were playing Bristol away on the Boxing Day.
Nice.
I think Bristol Rovers, I think it was. And we had to report to the Goldstone at 8 o'clock in the evening, Christmas Day evening, and get the bus down to Bristol City. And play them, Bristol Rovers, and play them on the Boxing Day, yeah.
So, like I said, we've kind of bypassed Freddie Goodwin a little bit, who, like I say, brought in Jeff Sidebottom, who didn't want to play for you. But, okay, in that case, I mean, obviously, we had some success with Pat Saywood. But at the beginning of the 71-72 season, was there a kind of an air around the place thinking, yeah, we can do this, we're definitely good enough to go up? Was there anything that really sort of brought about that thought that, you know, this was our season?
Yeah, they brought Bert Murray into the side, didn't he? Bert Murray was a very, very good player. I'm not sure if he came from Chelsea or he came from Birmingham. From Chelsea via Birmingham. But he was one of the best signings, I think, Pat Saywood made.
Right.
And I think it goes on results. You know, you suddenly start getting to the impetus of success. And, you know, we were picking up points away from home. We were actually getting points at home, winning quite often.
Mm.
And I think success in football is all about motivation. It's all about impetus. And if you get on the impetus, you know, you suddenly start feeling a little bit...
Winning becomes a habit.
Yeah, we're going to win here. And I can remember the two games in that season that we played Aston Villa.
Mm.
And, you know, we played on some grounds and you didn't feel a professional footballer. I mean, because the grounds were so bad.
Mm.
We were playing on inches of mud, playing with puddles and sand, you know. And then you go to somewhere like Aston Villa and it's like going out at Wembley and the changing rooms were brilliant, you know. I mean, we would go from somewhere like Doncaster, which was a tip in those days, or Gillingham, which was a tip in those days.
Still is.
Well, actually, it's not. The ground actually isn't bad.
It's improved, but the ground is not so much.
That's thanks to us, though.
Because Paul Scally is a big pal of mine. So,
oh, right,
yeah.
Okay.
But having said that, Gillingham is a good ground, but we played on terrible grounds. And then suddenly to go to somewhere like Villa, and we went up there, and I think we drew the first game up there.
Yeah.
And then at home, we beat them 2-1. And I think there was a 30-odd thousand crowd against Villa at home.
Yeah.
And you were playing in that game, weren't you? And you were at the other end of when John Templeton scampered through the pitch and laid it on a plate for Willian Irvine.
Yeah. Well,
what a goal that was.
It was on TV week after week, wasn't it?
Is it true? I mean, let's put it this way. I mean, how did it affect you? Because the word is that I think Frankie Howell was the groundsman at the time there. And because it was our first time ever on Match of the Day, he painted some of the bear patches green.
Well, I heard that story, but I don't believe it.
Certainly not the goal, not the penalty area. Anyway,
no, there was a rumor that he painted the corner, put some green emulsion on the corner, but I don't think that was true.
Right, okay. Because that goal from Willie Irvine was actually only in the sixth minute. People think it was the winner, but it wasn't. It was the first goal.
It was. Yeah. So the second goal was quite a soft affair, actually. They equalised, and I was partly to blame for that. They knocked a ball to the far post. I went out to punch it, and Eddie Spirit got under me, and I made a poor job of the punch out.
Right.
And then they got a goal from, they got equaliser from that.
Mm.
And then towards the end of the goal, they had the cricketer in goal for them, didn't they? The big guy.
Can't think.
Used to play for Worcester, cricketer. And ball came across, and it was an innocuous cross, and this guy was about 6'4". And he dropped it right to the feet of Kit Napier,
yeah,
who sort of stuck it in with his shin. You know, it was that close. And we won the game 2-1.
I mean, that must have been one of probably the first games that you played at the Goldstone with a 30,000 crowd. I mean, do you remember the anticipation of the day itself?
Yeah, but we had a lot of big crowds. The first big crowd I played in the Goldstone was when we beat Darlington for the fourth division. There was reputedly 36,000 there.
All right.
And I can remember standing in the south goal looking up at the gardens, which ran up Goldstone Lane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was hundreds of people up in the gardens, up there watching the game. Yeah, and we've had some big crowds down at the Albion. There's, I think, was it 28 or 30,000 for Villa?
Yeah, it was just, I think it was, someone told me it was just shy of 30,000 for that game.
But and I played against Chelsea down there. I think it was over 30,000.
I think it's the second highest attendance officially ever was that season at the Goldstone, was against Rochdale, of all people.
Oh, the last game of the season?
Last game of the season, something like 34,700 there.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't actually imagine it. Okay, who's your highest ever attendance against? Well, Fulham. Okay, great. And the second one? Rochdale. But, you know, that's the nature of it. And
Watford was a big one as well, wasn't it? But,
No, that was away. That was up. Oh, sorry. The 6-0 one. No, I don't think that was sort of kind of that big. But, yeah, so, yeah, and getting past, you know, Teg McDougall's Bournemouth, because it was just that the two teams went up at the time.
Yeah. Well, but I think we got a few points off them, didn't we? I think we beat them at home and drew away, didn't we, or something like that.
So. Yeah.
But Pat Saywood didn't last the next season.
I was about to say, what is it you said about, you said you quite liked him as your favourite manager. What was it about him that you liked?
Because I wanted to play for him. You know, he made you, Pat Saywood was a very good coach. Now, his problem was it was the first managerial job he'd had. But he was very, very good coach and spent an awful lot of time in detail. And he was a very fair man. You could talk to him. You could get your opinion across.
So if you're being dropped, he'd tell you why and not shy away from the decision.
He'd call you in his office and he'd put his arm around you if you're one of those players that needed to put his arm around you. I found him very fair and very honest, which in those days there wasn't many managers around that that were like that. But... to me, to play well, I need to want to play for the manager I'm playing. If I didn't like the manager or, you know, he wasn't for me, then I think it would affect your performance.
Okay.
And I think that's what happens these days. The managers actually lose their dressing room.
Yeah.
You know, and it's happened to
It's happening a lot
players.
At the moment.
It is, yeah.
There's particularly in the last week or so.
And that's what's happening because these players these days are earning so much money. You know, they don't need these managers who are threatening them with tearing up their contract if they don't do this or they don't do that. And that's what we used to get in our day.
Not as hungry.
We're not as hungry, but, I mean, managers used to threaten players with, you know, either you do this or I'll tear up your contract, or if you don't do that, I'll do this. You know, they used to threaten you. You know.
And that's not the way, yeah.
Mm.
Well, I did need to go back to something else that Mr. Templeman said. He said also he might like to make a few comments on Mr. Clough and Taylor. However, his response may not be fit for the radio.
Go on then, if you can, without swearing and without getting Radio Reverb closed down by Ofcom, tell us about your time with Cloughy and Taylor.
Well, I think the sad thing was that a year or so before Brian Clough came to the club, I was on holiday in Mallorca and I bumped into John McGovern, who was under him at Derby,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think also Notts Forest, and just happened over a beer. I said to him, you know, how'd you go? I think John McGovern would have run over Beachy Head for Brian Clough because he liked him, got on with him, and all the rest of it. So when I heard Brian Clough was coming, as sad as I was that Pat Sabre had left, or was leaving, or got sacked, whatever you want to call it, I was quite excited at the fact that this Brian Clough, you know, was coming to us.
I mean, it was a major coup for the club at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that was one of the things I couldn't understand, to be honest with you. We were struggling third division side, so what, you know, what was Brian Clough doing coming here? Mm. You know, who was supposed to going to be the next England manager, you know? So when they actually came to Brighton, we met up at the White Hart Hotel in Lewes, and I immediately took a dislike to both of them.
Because?
Because it wasn't about the club, it wasn't about the players, it was about them. Mm. You know, you call me boss, you call, I'm Peter, he's the boss, and if you're lucky enough to be here next year, you know, and all sort of rubbish like that. And to be honest with you, Brian Clough didn't want the job. He had no interest in managing Brighton because, A, he never moved to Brighton. We never saw him hardly ever in midweek. He would turn up about an hour before kickoff on the Saturday, and whatever mood he was in, he would berate players, shout at them, scream. His language was vile. And his henchman, Peter Taylor, was very much the same. And I think I said just now, I have to want to play for a manager, and I didn't want to play for them. And I know several players didn't, to be honest with you. Sometimes, even after a game, Brian Clough would leave to drive up to Derby or he had a chauffeur-driven car. We wouldn't see him after a game, and we wouldn't see him to... If we'd had a bad performance, you would expect him to come and say, you know, this is where we went wrong, you know, we should have done this and should have... We didn't see him. And then he would turn up, you know, an hour before kick-off the next week or meet us at the hotel if it was an away game. And then suddenly he would come out with a few, you know, sort of comments he would make on TV... And expect to motivate you.
So he was a manager by proxy, really.
Well, he was. And it was really, quite frankly, that he didn't want the job. I think it was he was on a quick earner, and it was a stepping stone.
And Mike Bamber did a sales job.
So. Yeah, well, with all respect, I think also Mike Bamber, I had a lot of respect for Mike Bamber, and I liked him, but he was a bit starstruck, Mike. Because, you know, he had the Ringma restaurant and he loved mixing with, you know, the top stars. And the Ringma used to get all the top stars, the Bruce Forsyths, the Tarbucks, and the rest of it. I think he got Claffey as a bit of a showboat thing, to be honest with you. I've got Brian Clough as my manager. And I think it was one of the worst moves the club ever made.
To be honest, I think we had, when we had John Vinicum on the show, probably about 5 years ago, probably only a couple of years before he died, sadly. But, I mean, he would tell a very similar story. You know, it wasn't just the players that put up with Cluffy's absence. He had to, you know, it was part of his job to interview the manager on a semi-regular basis. And just, if he wanted to talk to Cluffy, he had to go up to Derby to talk to him. That's poor form to run a...
Well, the funny story I'll tell you is I played up at York... Peter Grummett, who Peter Taylor brought in after the Bristol Rovers debacle when we got stuffed 8-2, he brought Peter Grummett in. And after a few games, Peter Grummett fractured his hip, right? Mm. So I got back in the side. We went up to York to play, and I broke my hand. I broke two fingers, and I broke my hand. So the following Friday, I've got a call to get to the manager's office, which was unusual that they were there. But they were both there, Brian Clough and Peter Taylor, on the Friday, and we were playing at home on the Saturday. Mm-hmm. They're telling me, I've got to play. I said, well, I've got a broken hand. How can I play? Well, you've got to play because we haven't got another goalkeeper. And as I got into the room, Brian Clough offered me a brandy. This is on a Friday before a game, so he's offering one of his players a brandy. And it was all bull.
Weird.
It was bull, you know, quite frankly.
Smoke and mirrors.
And... I detested the pair of them, I've got to be honest, you know.
Okay, well, we're running out of time, so we're going to move...
We've still got to get through. There's a couple of things I do want to ask. I mean, in your time as a goalkeeper, how would you define your style as a goalkeeper? I mean, were you a baller? Were you sort of like a...
I was a line keeper. And that means, basically, because of my stature, I wasn't coming out to the penalty area to take crosses. But then again, they don't do that these days because there were too many blocks going on. But I think today's football would expose a goalkeeper of my height, because in my day, we were playing on surfaces you wouldn't believe. I mean, players today, the game would be put off. Yeah. I mean, I played on pitches that were just totally unplayable.
But you're a similar height to Matty Ryan.
Not quite. He said he's 5'9", and Matt Ryan's 6 foot. At least has the grace to be 6 foot something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I'm sorry to say this, but Brian is my height. I'm 5'9", but you know, yeah.
But yeah. I think I was asked this question before somewhere in some format. How would I get on today? And I say I would probably be exposed today because of the conditions, because of the beautiful pitches, the light balls. Mm. You know, all the conditions are there today for the players to be better players than they were in my day. And I think in my day, I was a fairly brave goalkeeper. I would come out and punch. I'd come out and save at feet and this, that and the other. Mm. But I wasn't going to come out and take high crosses. But then again, in those days, the pinpoint crosses weren't really there because of the state of the pitches. You look at the pitches of today. If you can't play football on them, you can't play football.
Sure.
I mean, the pitches are stunning. They're beautiful.
Absolutely.
And I think in my day, I managed to cope as a short goalkeeper, whereas today I would probably struggle.
Sure. Mm. I mean, having a couple of giant centre-halves in front of you probably helped as well, didn't it?
Always did, yeah.
So, apart from yourself, who was the best goalkeeper of the Goldstein era?
Well, I mean, I can go back as far as Eric Gill. I mean, I grew up watching Eric Gill.
Mm. He's still going, isn't he?
Dave Hollins. Mm. Dave Hollins was a very good goalkeeper. So you mean, apart from me, who do I think the best goalkeeper was?
Of the Goldstein era.
It's a very difficult question to answer, to be honest with you. I would probably go for someone like Eric Gill.
Okay. Mm. Okay, so your last game for the Albion was away at Bristol Rovers, 27th of April, 1974. Mm-hmm. Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
Any idea who you were playing alongside that day? Okay.
Well, Norman, I think, would have been there.
Well,
Norman
actually, Gore. No.
Wasn't he? Was he injured?
No, I think Norman had his career was largely done. I think he decided he'd already told Peter Taylor that he was done, and I think he missed the last half dozen games. So I'll go through the team. Obviously number one, Mr. Powney. Number two was the aforementioned John Templeman. Three was Harry Wilson. Mm-hmm. Four, Ronnie Welsh. Five, Steve Piper, who would have probably been about 12 at the time.
Yeah. You play with nappies on, Steve, then.
Six, I'm not sure, 100% sure how to pronounce his name, Paul Fuscillo.
Yeah.
Seven, Billy McEwen. Mm-hmm. Eight, Tony Towner. Nine, mm-hmm. Kenny Beamish.
Yeah.
Ten, Lammy Robertson. Number 11, the omnipresent Peter O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
And in those days, you had a sub, and that would have been Ronnie Howell.
Yeah. Ronnie Howell, yeah.
So, did you know at the time that when that game was coming up that you were about to be turfed out?
Yes, in a way. It didn't surprise me, and B, I was quite happy with it as well.
Because you didn't, because you were done with Taylor.
I wasn't happy.
Sure.
Well, that is actually all we've got time for, amazingly. That flew past. So thank you, of course, to Alan Wes, and thank you so much to Brian Powney for coming in. There's so much we didn't ask you, but we'll try and get some of your questions in a bit.
It's my absolute pleasure.
Anyway, I've been Aidy Packham. This has been The Albion Rule. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll see you again soon. Bye.